This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Climate, of course. Debt limit, because we gotta. And a hot bubbling stew of economic promise to close the program. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, November the 2nd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Dateline Glasgow, Scotland, the COP26 meeting, the world coming together to address climate change with a teensy little bit of great power competition mixed in. President Biden told attendees at the conference today that there is an urgent need for high-quality, climate-friendly infrastructure in developing countries, and that he wants some of the world's most advanced economies to support that infrastructure globally. He didn't actually come out and say it, but his plan for that, it's called Build Back Better World, is a pretty clear attempt at countering China and its Belt and Road Initiative that has already financed hundreds of projects around the world. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour gets us going with that.
President Biden said he wants to offer developing countries a transparent alternative to, quote, debt traps and corruption. Many have interpreted that to be a clear reference to China's Belt and Road Initiative.
China has been going around the world having a lot of cash on hand and willingness to spend it, going to countries and saying, we will build you a railroad. We will build you a power plant.
Adam Posen is president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. That lending has been criticized for its lack of transparency in regard for social and environmental concerns.
Often with conditions that are either political or foreign policy vis-a-vis Taiwan, or just simply that take advantage of the borrowing countries.
The Council on Foreign Relations Task Force concluded that Belt and Road lending was contributing to unsustainable debt in poor countries, allowing subsidized market opportunities for state-owned Chinese companies, and promoting coal power. If the U.S. and G7 countries are going to provide an alternative, they're going to have to convince their private sectors to go along. That's where the financing would mostly come from, says Jonathan Hillman, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
There's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines. Something needs to be done, though, to make investing in some of these projects more attractive for those investors.
That is where details are limited right now. What kinds of incentives might come together to connect the money in the U.S. and its advanced economy allies to the needs of the developing world? In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
It's all in the details, always. In corporate news today, American Eagle Outfitters says it's buying the fulfillment company Quiet Logistics, the clothing brand's second acquisition this year. Why? You ask? Oh, yeah, you bet. It's a supply chain play. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at the shifting relationship between retailers and the companies they depend on to get stuff moving.
Right now, companies may not be able to control overseas factory shutdowns or overrun shipping ports, but they can control what's happening in their backyard, you know, if they buy the house.
Let's acquire some of that capacity so that we can control it and we can remove some of the uncertainty.
Morris Cohen is a professor of manufacturing and logistics at the Wharton School. He says Quiet Logistics' 8 fulfillment centers will help American Eagle cut down on costs and get their products to customers faster. Makes sense. But what's in it for Quiet Logistics? Karen Donahue, a professor of supply chain operations at the University of Minnesota, says the explosion in e-commerce means now is the time to grow.
you can't rest on your laurels. You can't be a logistics company that's, you know, kind of riding the tide now and not thinking of the next big thing.
That next big thing is partnerships that give companies like Quiet Logistics money to invest in robotics and other automated technologies. It also gives them better data from brands about the ebb and flow of products. And Patrick Donnelly, an analyst at Third Bridge, says that ebb and flow has been stressful for fulfillment companies, too. This deal will give Quiet Logistics real-time insight.
I think that there's more predictability and maybe more cohesiveness on the planning side. And really understanding the total supply chain needs of a major retailer like this.
And in the meantime, it'll give Quiet Logistics a guaranteed chunk of inventory all year round. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, neither inflation nor climate change nor political dysfunction will stay the major indices from their record highs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Somewhere deep in the Treasury building, which sits right next to the White House, there is somebody whose job it's been for the past 3 months to say, yep, we're paying this bill. Nope, we're not paying this one, to keep the government from bumping past the debt limit. Extraordinary measures is what those pay, don't pay decisions are called. And I should take a second here to remind you that this is money that's already been spent by Congress of both parties. And for another reminder, it's Republican senators who have refused persistently to raise the debt ceiling. The latest deadline to pull this $23 trillion economy back from the brink of default is December the 3rd.
Yeah, it's a recurring episode that has both political and economic consequences.
Carola Friedman studies financial history at Northwestern University.
Congress has revamped the limit since World War II 100 times.
Kathleen Day lectures at Johns Hopkins.
Sometimes it's suspended, sometimes it's raised.
And Eric Hilt is a professor at Wellesley.
But the reality is, as long as we're continuing to finance a lot of our budgets with deficit spending, Congress needs to revisit the issue from time to time.
So it's not a new thing.
The not new part of this debt ceiling thing is why we've gotten these three on the phone again. They're the economic historians we've been talking to since the early days of the pandemic for context on stuff happening now. Our lesson today, the debt limit, the origin story.
The debt ceiling is a vestige of a time when Congress was much more heavily involved in federal borrowing.
Like how?
Basically, every time that the Treasury needed money, they would get authorized a certain amount for whatever it is that they needed.
They would write legislation for specific bond issues.
A nice example is the construction of the Panama Canal.
A little job connecting the Atlantic and Pacific.
So here's how it worked. In 1902, Congress authorized the Treasury to issue Panama Canal bonds. The money from those bonds could only be used for that one project. Other projects, whatever the government wanted to do, were funded with their own bonds or their own taxes, and Treasury had to keep all those little piles of money separate.
That works when the economy and the projects are relatively simple and they're small.
Then when the U.S. entered World War I...
April 6, 1917.
That is a type of conflict where the financial needs are, first of all, unprecedented and also highly uncertain.
The American forces capture the base of the largest artillery weapon developed during the war.
And so this idea that you could go and specify how much you needed to borrow and you would be authorized for a particular type of security, a certain amount, it just doesn't work.
And so
Congress passed a law granting the Treasury the authority to issue war bonds up to some fixed amount. I think it was $5 billion at the time.
And presto, the first debt ceiling.
Eventually, that evolved into the debt limit that we have now, which is a single overall limit for all federal debt.
And the whole idea is to give the government more, or the Treasury, more flexibility.
That flexibility thing is key here. How much debt the Treasury Department feels it needs to sell to fund government projects, what denomination bonds and bills, and at what maturities. It's Janet Yellen's job to figure that out. And like Kathleen Day said earlier, the cap on how much Treasury can borrow to pay for everything that, again, Congress has already spent has been changed almost 100 times since World War II. It's now up to nearly $29 trillion.
To have that in the back of your mind, I do think gives people pause about how they're spending money. But it hasn't always been done with all the acrimony and political football-ness that we now have.
Remember what's at stake here.
And, you know, it goes back to Alexander Hamilton. His first argument, the reason Alexander Hamilton is so famous is he's the person who said to George Washington and convinced the new American government, you can't default on your debt.
In fact, it's right there in the Constitution, Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, which says in relevant part, the validity of the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned. That's a quote. And the present day reality is that the global market for U.S. debt is the biggest and most liquid debt market in the world precisely because we pay what we owe. And we should be clear here. This is not an economic problem. It's politics all the way down.
Making our interest payments, making our required payments associated with our debt is perfectly feasible.
But at the end of the day, it doesn't make for very good policy, this gamesmanship and this let's get to the brink to see who will blinkmanship.
We get in this political tug of war until there is some kind of relaxation, and that's been a very complicated, often painful process. So something that was supposed to make things more flexible has become quite binding and constraining.
And political. Thanks once again to our panelists, Eric Hilt at Wellesley, Carola Friedman at Northwestern, and Kathleen Day at Johns Hopkins. If you have a question for us, by the way, send it to us. Marketplace.org is where you can do it. If you've been trying your best to ignore this whole crypto thing, first of all, I hear ya. But it might be time to start paying attention because at this point, your favorite musician might know this stuff a little bit better than you do. The Grammys announced this week that next year's show would be commemorated by a series of NFTs, non-fungible tokens, kind of a combination of digital art and digital receipt, or thinking with our economic brain here, a way to make digital things scarce and thus more valuable. The R&B artist Doja Cat has already sold one, kind of a multimedia logo thing, for $188,000. Marketplace's Matt Levin takes it from there.
Steve Aoki is one of the most famous EDM DJs on the planet. Tell me what you know about dreaming. For the unfamiliar, EDM stands for electronic dance music. Ask your kids, or just ask that annoying coworker who won't shut up about Burning Man. Last year, Aoki was bored. The pandemic nixed the endless stream of live shows that was his life, not to mention his biggest income source. So he did what a lot of people with unexpected downtime did in 2020. He got into collectibles.
I got like the Michael Jordan rookie card for $85,000 in September. I got two of those.
Not a cheap hobby. But around the same time, Aoki was getting into selling his own collectibles. He collaborated with a digital artist to make something he called the Dreamcatcher series. Picture a GIF set to this music of what looks like a rotating animated Sour Patch Kid if the Sour Patch Kid was a character in a Tim Burton movie. Hey, art is subjective. One person's Dreamcatcher series is another person's Van Gogh. And the Dreamcatcher series fetched Van Gogh prices $4 million.
The same way people are buying jerseys of their favorite athletes or buying Pokemon, whatever it is that they're collecting. Now, music is another huge collectible industry.
In a world where musicians earn way less than a penny per Spotify stream and live touring can disappear overnight, Aoki sees digital memorabilia as an important new revenue source. And with crypto on their side, artists aren't limited to selling collectibles. They can experiment with models like initial song offerings or ISOs.
And that is basically the opening of a song or a piece of a song on our marketplace.
Steve Stewart is the CEO of Vest, an app that allows users to buy fractionalized shares of music rights, kind of like owning a stock. I'm checking out the app right now. All right, let's see what songs I can purchase as part of an ISO. White Wedding by Billy Idol. Is Billy Idol still alive? Hold on one second. Billy Idol is still alive, but he's getting up there in years. Not to sound too morbid, but could be a good investment. I bought $5 worth of White Wedding.
And that may sound like a small piece, and it is, but it gives that person some skin in the game.
So every time you hear this,
it's a nice day for a white wedding,
I get a cut. Stewart says eventually I'll be able to buy shares of songs as NFTs, which through the magic of blockchain might deliver my minuscule royalties that much faster. Some musicians want to go a step further, selling bigger chunks of song equity to fans and bypassing record labels entirely. But for all the hype around how crypto can change the music industry for the better, there are plenty of skeptics. Nika Danilova has been making music under the stage name Zola Jesus for over a decade. She's experimented with multimedia NFTs, sold a couple. But the experience left a bad taste in her mouth. She only sees rich tech types buying and selling art to other rich tech types. And something about turning fans into investors doesn't feel right to her.
Anyone can bid to own a piece of the artist. I don't think any artist should be actually owned by anybody other than themselves.
Fans won't just be mad when an artist makes an album they don't like. They might dump their shares. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we're probably in the bottom of the first inning.
Trust me, it's better than the bottom of the ninth. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 138 today, almost 0.4%, 36,052 for the blue chips. Dow 36,000, you heard that before. NASDAQ up 53 points, 0.3%, ended things at 15,649. The S&P 500 up 16, about 0.3%, 46.30. Today in what? Avis Budget up more than 108% today after third quarter earnings beat analyst expectations handily, I might add. Health-related stocks looked robust today. COVID vaccine maker Pfizer shot up 0.4% on better-than-expected third-quarter profit and revenue and expects $36 billion worth of revenue from the vaccine this year. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.54%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Carbon dioxide, CO2, to the scientifically inclined out there, gets all the global warming glory. But CH4 is the pollutant in the news today. Methane was on the agenda at the climate meeting in Glasgow, where promises were made to cut down sharply on global methane emissions, a gas that can be more harmful than CO2 in the short term. And related, back here, the Environmental Protection Agency proposed some new rules today on methane emissions from oil and natural gas production facilities. Marketplace's Caroline Champlin has that one.
It's not easy to find leaking methane, says University of Colorado professor Greg Reeker. It's colorless and odorless.
It's not like when it's in your house, they've added an odor so that you can smell it if it's leaking.
For the last 10 years, people have used an infrared camera to find leaks. On the black and white monitor, the gas shows up as a ghostly plume.
It almost looks like a shimmering on the camera. But what's important is the camera itself is, you know, about $100,000. And then you need a person that's trained to interpret the images.
These days, there's new methane tracking technology. Rieker himself has started a company that uses a laser beamed from a tower to comb for methane in the air at oil and gas facilities.
It automatically just moves from facility to facility and checks over and over and over again all day and all night.
The EPA encourages oil and gas companies to use this kind of new tech, says Professor Arvind Ravikumar with the University of Texas at Austin.
From drones to airplanes to satellites that detect methane emissions and that provide various advantages.
The lasers, for example, would work well surveying flat land, but drones might be better at navigating forests, says Ravikumar.
The new EPA rule gives operators the flexibility to choose the most cost-effective option for their specific operation.
And Ravikumar says the EPA could use the same technology for enforcement. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
Whatever winds up getting decided in Glasgow, one of the things we're going to have to get our arms around as we transition to renewables is batteries for cars and for the grid and for everything else. The catch is that most of the batteries we're going to need to use need lithium. We don't produce much of it in this country, and we are trying to ramp up. Our new podcast, How We Survive, is all about the race for a domestic supply of lithium, and that today takes us to the Salton Sea in the desert of Southern California, where there's actually a ton of this stuff, enough just in this part of California to supply 40% of the entire global market. The global market, right here in Southern California. The only problem, well, here's Molly Wood. She's the host of How We Survive.
The Salton Sea is a place that feels stranger than fiction.
You are looking at a remarkable idea.
This is from an old ad called Miracle in the Desert.
An idea that has intrigued and attracted and literally thrilled thousands upon thousands of men, women, and children.
The Salton Sea refers to the region and a body of water in Southern California almost to the Mexican border that back in the 1950s and 60s was marketed as Palm Springs, but with water. I drove around there this summer, and you can still see the vibey old signs for beaches, hot springs, resorts, a yacht club. But these days, the businesses are long gone. In fact, this area now has one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. And the sea itself is receding into a salty, increasingly toxic concentrate, which is partly why this area also has one of the highest asthma rates in the country. But the boiling hot brine just below the Earth's surface here could provide some hope. It's full of lithium, and there are several companies at the Salton Sea trying to develop technology to extract that lithium.
So there's a lot of opportunity if you think about it as a blank canvas.
That is Rod Colwell. He's the CEO of Controlled Thermal Resources, one of those companies hoping to strike it rich with lithium and other critical minerals from the Salton Sea. The best and really only way to get the lithium out is to build a geothermal power plant, renewable energy generated from capturing steam from the brine as it cools. After it's cooled, companies will extract the lithium, then pump the brine back into the earth to heat up and get used again. And compared to other forms of lithium mining, this is pretty dang green. Out in the desert, Rod took me out to Red Hill, one of the highest points in the area that overlooks everything. He has a big dream, including building a whole campus for this project.
We want trees. We want greenery.
He imagines a massive geothermal plant, eventually maybe even battery production on site.
So when you look out from this point, you have a whole different picture in your mind.
Oh, my God, I can see this. I can see a plant there and a cathode facility over there, a park over there, kangaroos jumping around.
Rod plans to start selling lithium from the brine by 2024. All he needs to do is build this sucker. But it won't be easy. Although he has some private funding and a grant from the state, the technology he plans to use to get the lithium doesn't totally exist yet outside of a lab or pilot project. And it has never succeeded at a commercial scale. But the promise of a greener future with more economic opportunity and cleaning up the landscape, well, a lot of people living in the communities near the Salton Sea are hopeful and want to see these industries succeed. Frank Ruiz is the Salton Sea director of the Audubon Society and an expert on the history and the ecology of the region.
It will benefit California. It will benefit the nation as a whole.
I met up with him at the North Shore Beach and Yacht Club, where he told me the dying sea is a danger to the whole valley.
I think the birds are good indicators of how good or how bad your environment is. And a lot of the bird species are either dying or flying away. Mm-hmm. And are we next down the line?
Yeah. Spoiler alert, Frank says, yeah.
I think we're at the brink of one of the major ecological collapses in the next, you know, year or two.
And while you wouldn't think that lithium extraction could help a region on the verge of an ecological collapse, Frank hopes the companies that want their workforce to come from the Imperial Valley will have an incentive to help keep it healthy. Rod hopes his company will bring economic opportunity and environmental benefits to the community, but remember, he has yet to lay a single brick. Meanwhile, a competing company in the Salton Sea is taking a more cautious approach.
I guess if this were a baseball game, we're probably in the bottom of the first inning.
Jonathan Weisgall is the VP of Government Regulations at the giant Berkshire Hathaway Energy. The company has funding from both the state and the Department of Energy to develop a process to extract lithium from geothermal brine. Jonathan says if all goes well and if the lithium market stays strong, they'll begin construction in 2024.
We've recovered it in the laboratory, but we've got to show that we can do it on a commercial scale. So we want to rush, but at the same time, we have got to crawl before we walk, and we have to walk before we run.
In the meantime, the local community and the U.S., which is trying to cultivate a domestic supply of lithium, are hoping that geothermal extraction can be the new miracle in the California desert. I'm Molly Wood for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so, and hopefully none of you bought the Squid Coin. I mentioned this last week, a crypto coin tied to the hit Netflix series Squid Game. And I also mentioned that coin had gone up more than 86,000% just last week, from a penny to like 11 bucks or something. And I said, don't do that. Again, I really hope you did not. It peaked this weekend at $2,861 and then fell pretty much instantaneously to $0. Gizmodo figures somebody or somebodies walked away $3.3 million richer. All right, we're out, but super quick, here's your moment of economic context. Two words, Fed tomorrow. Oh, no, wait, three words, taper. If you know, you know. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.